Well, good afternoon. Thank you for coming to this session. I'm pretty passionate about bacterial blight on cotton, so I'll be happy to share what I know about it. The symptoms of bacterial blight. So in a cotton field, there's all sorts of things that spot up your leaves. There's fungi, there's spray applications that spot up the leaves. There's maybe three unique things about bacterial blight. First off, the lesions are small. They're dark brown, they're blocky, they're not circular. Many of your other types of spots on leaves are more circular. Bacterial blight is more blocky, and it's very dark in color. Only a few things are that dark in color. The other, number two, is you get water soaking on the bottom side of the leaf. So if you turn it over, particularly early on in a blight infection, it's water soaking around those lesions. And certainly spray application lesions are not going to be water soaked. The third point is they go all the way through the leaf. They actually show up first on the underside, and then you see it later on the top side. So most of your other spots are going to be on the top side first and may never make it to the bottom side. So those three points will help you to distinguish when you have bacterial blight as opposed to some other things. This is a slide that Jason Woodward put together. It shows your little blocky lesions. It shows your venal necrosis when they're actually running down the veins. It shows where they start to coalesce and get a little bit bigger. And then from Tom Isaacy, you actually see the black arm symptom that can occur. These are, again, showing the water soaking a little bit closer, the blocky nature of it, and then the bacteria showing water soaking on the veins, where that'll turn into venal necrosis. And you just don't see other organisms or other problems causing that kind of symptom. So that's pretty diagnostic when you see either of those. Now, sometimes you'll see some chlorosis around the lesions. And it seems to be a little more common maybe in the Mid-South. There's been lots of discussion with the plant pathologists. I will say that I rarely see the chlorosis, and when I do, I always isolate a lot of fungi. So when I'm isolating bacteria off of a leaf, it's fairly clean of fungi unless I see chlorosis, and then there's a lot more fungal contamination. And so I don't know if that's a bacterial blight symptom, but I think it's more related to maybe fungi being present as well. And then this is another series of pictures from Jason Woodward and sort of going back to the issue Bob Nichols brought up, seed. So the bacteria can cause lesions on bowls, you can get staining of your lint, and it gets into the dang seed. Most of the bacteria may be external on the seed, but you can get bacteria internal to the seed. And that's the problem with seed spread. Just a few other pictures that I just pulled off the internet of other types of spots that are not blight. You see alternaria leaf spot there, circular, lighter in color. You see target spot here. Color-wise, it's similar to the blight, the bacterial blight. But that lesion is entirely different shape than you get with the bacteria. Now, back to bacterial blight and seed. So I dug back in the literature to 2005, the variety planted estimates that come out every year. And I do a lot of work with varieties, and I started screening in 2000, so I have a pretty good historical reference of all the different varieties and whether they're susceptible or resistant to bacterial blight. And for Georgia, which is in blue, Mississippi in green, or Texas in red, I just tracked the percent of acres that were planted to susceptible varieties. And so you all can see there are a little bit different dynamics in each of the three states. Georgia had a dramatic upswing after 2009. Mississippi started their upswing earlier, actually, and then kind of completed the planting of susceptible varieties. Texas was a slower, gradual increase. But the fact is, when we get to 2015, 2016, all three states are primarily planting susceptible varieties. So it's not a surprise that bacterial blight is flared. I mean, this map tracks pretty well with the problem flaring starting in 2011. And where it flared in 2011. They were planting a lot of susceptible varieties. And they used to not plant them. Let's track what resistant varieties were used. If you go back to 2005 in Georgia, Delta Pine, the triple nickel, Delta Pine 555BGRR. You had 73% of the acres planted in 2005, and that number even went up into the 80s until you got to 2009 when it started to drop, and then 2010, you could no longer plant after that the variety. And so you saw the acreage plummet down of triple nickel. You saw a little bit of Fibromax being planted in 2012 that were resistant, and you saw some of Phytogen 375 that came in 2010. Now I'm going to switch up to the Mississippi situation. They like Delta Pine 444 BGRR and Delta Pine 555 BGRR. So you saw the two of those commanded about 46% in 2005 of the acreage. Stoneville 5599 BR, BGRR or BR commanded the 26%. So that's where you saw a lot of resistant, acres, to bacterial blight. And you saw that number maintained for a couple years, and then starting in 2007, you saw the Delta Pine varieties drop to 26%, and you saw Stoneville 5599 BR had actually dropped after 2005. And the reason it dropped was because Stoneville 5458 B2RF came in. Those were both nematode-resistant varieties. Well, Stoneville 5458 was susceptible to bacterial blight. So we lost all that protection on our root knot ground at that point. And then you could see after 2008, Mississippi was basically all susceptible varieties. There was almost no resistant varieties for the next several years. In 2011, you saw Phytogen 375 jump up to 23%. And so that did help in 2011. But there was very little else at that point being planted that was resistant. If we go into Texas, we saw a lot of different varieties being planted, but basically they were Fibromax and they were resistant to bacterial blight. And you saw that stayed consistent until 2011, where you saw the Fibromax starting to drop, but the next gen resistant varieties were being picked up. So the proportion of resistant acres was still hanging in there. Now let's talk from 2011 to current, and let's start back with Georgia. So we saw Phytogen 375 was a predominant one, but it wasn't very many acres. And then we saw that even drop. You saw Stoneville 6448 picked up a few acres. Phytogen collectively that were resistant picked up, had a few acres being planted. But you saw the numbers were just dismal until 2017. 2016, Delta Pine 1646 came in. 2017, its acreage just jumped. It was obviously a popular variety, and it has at least some resistance to bacterial blight. If we look at Mississippi, same thing. We're in a quandary. We have a little Stoneville 6448, a little Phytogen. Stoneville 5289 had some acres for a few years. Delta Pine 1133 picked up a few. But it wasn't until in Mississippi, both Delta Pine 1518 and Delta Pine 1646 was what is triggering the change in Mississippi. And that's what's leading the charge, at least in that area, to have more blight-resistant varieties out there. We look in Texas, as our Fibromax acreage dropped, we saw a big drop in 2014, or a bigger drop in 2014. 2015, it continued to go down. So we're seeing the dicamba resistance come in. People are moving away from the Fibromax in essentially Fibromax areas because they want the dicamba resistance, and they went with susceptible varieties. But then you saw in 2017, you saw kind of a resurgence. NextGen had 17% of the acres. They have some blight-resistant varieties. They have the dicamba resistance. Fibromax is pulling in about 13%. Delta Pine 1646 is picking up 8%, and the new Enlist varieties from Phytogen are almost all immune to bacterial blight. They have very strong resistance. And so you're starting to see some of those numbers popping up now. So that's where we're at in terms of planting varieties with resistance to blight. And I think you'll see Delta Pine, of their new varieties that came out in 18, the majority of them are resistant to blight. I think all the new Phytogen varieties coming out, they're all immune to bacterial blight. You know, the next gen has about maybe a 50-50 mix of blight-resistant varieties for 2018. So the trends are upwards. The seed companies are doing what they need to do to get choices out there with the various herbicide technologies, the BT genes, and the blight resistance. And so it's really nice to see how the seed industries are responding. So we know that the seed can be infected and that a small percent of the bacteria survives internally. And some of that even may be insects are related to getting it internal in the seed. I looked into California, because they eradicated bacterial blight, and I looked at what they did, and what they really emphasized was the plant material. The plant is infected, that material stays, if it stays on the surface of the ground, you will get new infection that next year. It survives very well for at least 1 year in the crop debris. And so that's an important thing. If you're looking at reducing blight, you're going to need to deep plow that material, get it off the soil surface. And that was very important in the reduction of that disease in California. And we go back to the California. The other thing they noted was the sprinkler irrigation. A blight was triggered when sprinkler irrigation came into California. So one of the ways they reduced it was going back to furrow watering in those fields that had bacterial blight. It also was the crop rotation away from cotton for a year, deep plowing the residue, and even watering that residue, because in the arid environments, the bacteria survives perfectly. If you wet that material like you see natural from rainfall in the rest of the country, it actually kills some, it degrades, the bacteria goes away quicker. So that was another option, another thing in California. And then they did not harvest seed from blight fields and use that for planting seed. They're very strict about that, but even to the point of not ginning that seed in gins that had bacterial blight infestations. They were very careful about all those. And then really the last was resistant varieties. The last and the least, I would say. It was more an emphasis on these other points. And then there was a paper given last year about survival on weed hosts. So we don't have weed hosts in the U.S., if it's not on cotton, it's not going to infect other plant types. However, this work last year showed that they looked at four fields that had blight the year before. They looked at weeds around the field, and it was actually surviving epiphytically. There wasn't a lot of it, but in three of the four sites, they got it out of weeds. And I have done a little research since that in other Xanthomonas-type situations. And that's not the first time that this has been published. There's a new publication coming out of other, the same species, other pathotypes, where they're also finding epiphytic survival on weeds or other hosts, non-hosts. And so maybe this is playing a role that we didn't appreciate. Basically, the inoculum's out there now. I'm not as worried about seed contamination. I mean, it's very important not to have your seed contamination, but there's a lot of inoculum out there. So it's going to come in when you see rainy, windy conditions that wound the plants, the water has to be there to get infection. Basically, once you get infection, it takes 14 days to start seeing symptoms. And that may change by a few days depending on the temperatures. It'll slow down and take longer under cooler conditions. It'll be a little faster under warm conditions. I will say, though, in seed fields, there is no reason to have seed fields with blight infections, because when you get the right environmental variables, you know that blight is coming, and you should go out 3 weeks after those conditions and scout for it. This year we had the conditions around the 4th of July. I emailed our IPM agents 3 weeks later, hey, are you seeing blight? Yes. I mean, it's really easy to predict the timing. Rainy, windy, wounding type events Go about 3 weeks later and look to see if the fields have it. It's not rocket science. I infect plants with the organism every year to screen germplasm. And so this is the technique I use. I'm just going to throw it out there. I have plates of the bacteria. I grow up this tryptocase soy broth on a shaker for a day and a half after I inoculate it with the bacteria. These are plastic 1 liter flasks. I put two flasks in a 50-gallon tank of water plus this magical potion Silhouette L77. And then when we make the applications, we use low pressure, 20 PSI, and we spray over the top at 50 gallons to the acre. And that's a picture of a spraying a nursery. And you can see it's a pretty heavy volume of water, but it's not, there's no pressure, there's no wounding. The Silhouette will move the bacteria into the plants very quickly. So we can do it when it's 100 degrees and still get excellent disease. I mean, you can put it out under any, almost any environmental conditions, as long as it's not raining hard when you actually spray it. The rain will wash it off the plant or down the plant. But other than that, you can put it out under all sorts of weather conditions. And it's very reliable. So 14 to 21 days later, I rate the plants for infections. This technique does not cause bowl infections very often. You can treat young plants. You can treat the old plants don't do quite as well. It's better to treat younger leaves. And late season treatments, when it starts to cool off, you don't always get all the way to good symptom development. They can be pretty late. If you're spraying it, and for our year, if we're spraying it from, say, the 15th or 20th of August on, sometimes if it cools down, you won't get a good lesion development. And then the water quality is critical. I cannot use city water and get consistent symptoms. I have to use well water, water that's not treated. This is just some results. How am I doing time-wise? Okay, excellent. So these are some results from this year's trials. This is mixing a couple trials together. We used Chex, Phytogen 499, Widestrike Flex is a susceptible Chex, and NextGen 3406, B2XF, I use as susceptible Chex. Our resistant Chex are Delta Pine 1518, B2XF, and Fibermax 1830, GLT. And so some of the new varieties that are coming out, NextGen 4601, B2XF, highly susceptible. Cropland Genetics 3527, B2XF, highly susceptible. Delta Pine 1725, B2XF, highly susceptible. Delta Pine 1835, B3XF, highly susceptible. And then we move into what I'd call moderately susceptible, and that's Phytogen 312, and Phytogen 444, Widestrike Flex, and then the new NextGen 4792XF. Now we're moving into a category called partially susceptible. So it gets lesions, but not as many, and they may not get as big. They may be a little smaller. The partially susceptible varieties are Delta Pine 1612, and then we've got Delta Pine 1646. So 1646 is battling bacterial blight in the U.S. That is the number one resistant variety that's battling bacterial blight. But it's not as resistant as I would like it to be. It's more falling in that partially resistant, partially susceptible category. You can see here it's got 40% blight incidence when we treated it. And then a true partial resistance is something like Phytogen 243, somewhere more around that 25% mark. And then all the other varieties are resistant. Some of the new ones are Delta Pine 1820, B3XF, NextGen 4777, B2XF, Delta Pine 1639, B2XF, Delta Pine 1851, B3XF, Phytogen 490, Widestrike 3FE, NextGen 4689, B2XF, NextGen 5711, B3XF, Delta Pine 1845 B3XF, Delta Pine 1840 B3XF, Phytogen 300, Widestrike 3FE, Phytogen 330, Widestrike 3FE, Phytogen 340, and then Phytogen 450. I put out a list of resistant varieties every year, and I'm waiting for the new Phytogen decisions on the new varieties, which will be sometime in January. And as soon as I get that, I'll make a new list available to everybody. I've got everything else incorporated already with these new varieties. So I wanted to compare the results for my testing in 2 years. This is 2016 and 2017. Your high temperatures, 2017 are the red solid lines, and in 16 are the dotted lines. So we made an application, and then it was quite warm both years. For the first week, it was 95 degrees or hotter. And then in 2017, it cooled off dramatically. In 2016, when I went to look at the plots 14 days after planting, disease had already completely expressed in susceptible varieties, and the leaves were falling off in droves. It took another day or two longer for the moderately susceptible to respond, but if we had to rate 14 days after planting, or there would have been nothing left to rate. In 2017, I had to rate 24 days after planting. It took, the susceptible developed in 14 to 20 days, but I had to give the moderately susceptible, partially susceptible a little bit longer to develop. So that's kind of an idea of the role that temperature can play. So 14 days you had to rate in 2016 with the high temperatures. 24 days is when I had to rate in 2017. So there is some difference that weather can make. We actually ended up with more disease in 2017, but it took longer to develop. The boxes are rain events that occurred to help encourage the disease get going. In 2017, we had some rain events. In 2016, we had a little piddly rain event there at 20 days after planting. But it basically was a hot and dry summer. We still got excellent disease, but it developed very quickly, and then it disappeared. These are just the results from the 2 years. The solid bars are 2016. The striped are 2017. So you see with our highly susceptible phytogen 499, 100% disease in both years. It's when we got to the moderately susceptible phytogen 312 that we first saw a little bit of a difference. We had less disease in 2016 than we did 2017. But relative to the susceptible, we saw differences still. And then with the partially or the moderately susceptible 444 from phytogen was very much identical in both years. The partially resistant, partially susceptible Delta Pine 1612 was interesting. I guess I'm done. Okay. Well, 2016, we had a little under 50% disease. 2017, it went up to about 75. So your partially susceptible and partially resistant Delta Pine 1646 was where it varied the most from year to year. But they still, held their position. That, you know, relatively speaking, they still separated out well. And then phytogen 243 was partially resistant both years, and then your resistant ones, you didn't see any disease. So these techniques, even when the weather differs quite a bit, are still, from a relative standpoint, you can still separate out what's resistant, what's susceptible, what's partially susceptible, that kind of category. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about races. So races have been identified as early as the 1950s. In the U.S., we started to see races because our resistant variety started to fail. A set of different cultivars was established to be able to identify what race you had, and that was by Hunter et al. In 1968. In 1977, race 18 was formally established. I believe it was identified first in 1973, by Luther Bird up in the High Plains of Texas. And then by 1977, everyone was confident, okay, we've got a new race. It was probably developed from race 10. Race 10 was very aggressive. And then it mutated fairly easily into what became race 18. And so race 18 was every bit as aggressive as 10, but it also could cause spots on varieties that had been immune to race 10. And then Peggy Thaxton has done a great job over the years, or used to look for what the race distribution was. And by 1992 or 1991, race 18 was in most of the fields. And by 2000, Peggy could not find anything but race 18. So we have stayed stable with race 18 across the U.S. since 2000 or earlier. And that's interesting, because in the early years we saw a lot of changing of races. But once we developed a very sound source of resistance, a combination of resistance genes, race 18 has not been able to mutate since then. However, in 2015, to my horror, I found bacterial blight developing in a field of Fibromax 1830 GLT. That's an immune variety. There should not have been a lesion in that field. And the grower called me. I came running out to look at that field, and it had dropped a lot of the spots that had excited the grower. It had defoliated, not defoliate entirely, but the spots had actually dropped out. Well, I had a variety test in that field, and blight really picked up on the susceptible varieties, but it was there, at least at low levels, on my resistant varieties. And that's impossible. These varieties are immune. That's impossible. So I was really nervous that a new race had developed. And this is a picture from that grower's fields. It looked like a hail event had come through, but there hadn't been any hail. But there was all these holes in the darn leaves. So in 2016, Rebecca Bart, who's in the Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis, she and her graduate student Ann came down actually and looked at, actually they came down in 2015, they looked at the field, they took samples, and they accidentally found this new bacteria from those samples. It was a Pseudomonas syringae. And they put it on cotton, and they could cause disease on cotton. And so late in 2016, we started to look for it in the last field of blight that came in that year. And oh my gosh, that's almost all I isolated. I mean, it was loaded, and it was a bad blight field. It was just hammered. It was a variety study. There were lesions on resistant plants. And it was loaded up with this Pseudomonas syringae. So this year I started to look in all of my blight samples that came in, and we found, and I want to recognize Tyler Mays back there, an IPM agent. He brought us a lot of great samples. And by gosh, we found it in 8 additional sites. And so it's at least reasonably well distributed out there. When I inoculated on a cotton seedling, in 2 days, it has spread from that X that I inoculate and spread all through that cotyledon and basically killed a good part of the leaf. And then it stops. It dries up and just stops. So it doesn't behave exactly like Xanthomonas would. It's much faster. Xanthomonas takes at least 10 days to show symptoms. This shows symptoms 48 hours after I inoculate. But this one will stop at some point and that lesion will dry up. And in a field, at least, presumably it might even fall out. So it is a different organism. It behaves differently. So I guess the question is, if we put the two together, can we explain why we have symptoms on resistant plants? Because this Pseudomonas goes to our resistant varieties just fine. The answer is we're still working on it because we haven't been able to throw them together and duplicate what we're seeing in the field. That hasn't happened correctly. They fight each other. They don't work together. They, in fact, inhibit each other when we throw them together. So this is still in progress, but we think that may be why we're getting some symptom development in our resistant varieties. At least maybe getting infection started. I don't know that it builds up. So I do want to thank my collaborators, first and foremost, the Plains Cotton Growers Improvement Program. They funded my bacterial blight program consecutively since 2000. That allows us to continually working in this project to have good techniques. Cotton Incorporated, and then we have a NEPA grant to actually look at these Pseudomonas isolates and these Xanthomonas isolates. And then my collaborators, Jason Woodward, Tom Isaacete, Rebecca Bart, Tom Allen, and Bob Kimmerite. Thank you.